I want to ask you a question straight out, flat out. I want you to give me the honest answer. What do you think the chances are of
me not discarding this important card with Gamble?
Well, Lloyd, that's difficult to say, and we really don't...
Hit me with it! Just give it to me straight! I came a long way just to see you, Mary. Just... least you can do is level with me. What are my chances?
Not good.
You mean not good like 1 out of 100?
I'd say more like 1 out of 1,000,000.
So you're telling me there's a chance? Yeah!
All right, are we gonna make a podcast?
Yes.
Great. Then let me welcome our listeners to this episode of Lucky Paper Radio. My name is Andy, and I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Anthony, born a gambling man, Maddox.
Incorrect. Try again.
You cast Gamble on Tuesday, though. You're playing.
Oh, I did.
You were playing
cast Gamble.
Fair Gamble, yeah, in the Neoclassical, yeah, cube.
Yeah, it was actually a lot of fun. I had a couple creatures with Madness. I had some cards with Flashback. I ended up just casting Gamble to get like a basic land a couple times when I had rough hands, and it was fine.
I love to hear this. This is what I want Gamble to do in that cube.
I even cast Gamble with an empty hand one time, and my opponent was. I mean, it was very funny because they're like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm going to cast Gamble. And they're like, you have no cards in hand. And I'm like, I know this.
And you go and get Arrogant Worm.
Yeah. Very good.
I mean, it's kind of sick, honestly.
It was good.
Like, a Green Sunzi.
I needed another creature
in
play.
Yeah, I mean, it seems okay. That's exciting. It's the first report I've heard of playing Gamble in that cube because it's a relatively recent addition. And people often just don't play it. They just are like, oh, this is bad because RNG. But
it felt like I could sculpt when I was using it. Like, obviously, discarding a card at random is not what you want to be doing, but when
Hot
I was
take.
In an opening hand, it was like,
big
oh,
strategic
I'm
advice here
from
Anthony.
Cast this before doing anything else so I have the best chance to not discard the thing I need, or I'm just going to wait till I have 3 things I don't mind discarding late in the game.
That sounds very exciting. That's exactly what I want that card to be, so I'm into it. And I'm really glad to hear this because you ended your night on a Gamble awful bad beat, so the fact that your overall impression was this was fine and fun...
I did, yeah. I totally forgot about that. And now you've dredged this back where I had, yeah, I could discard any one of the 4 cards in my hand except for one, and I needed to yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's more specific than that. You had Goblin Bombardment in play.
Mm-hmm. I had one creature in play. My opponent was at 9.
You did not have a creature in play.
I had to because it added up to exactly lethal. I'm pretty sure I had some random creature.
It must have just been not green then, because the whole point was you had Natural Order in your hand, and you had Symbiotic Worm in your deck.
Right.
And you had to gamble and basically not discard the Natural Order that was already in your hand when you gambled, which I said afterwards that your opponent almost certainly thought you were gambling for the Natural Order, but you were actually just trying to get any green creature, basically.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. So I got Call the Herd because I could either cast it and then Natural Order that next turn, or if I discarded it, I could still flash it back,
creature,
and it would be
a
turn later, but I might still be able to survive for 2 turns.
Yeah, but then it was going to be exactly lethal with the Symbiotic Worm plus Goblin Bombardment,
yes,
and that one other creature.
Would have been so
play,
good.
Which would have been very cool, but then you discarded exactly the Natural Order.
Yep.
Well, I'm sorry to dredge that back up. I think Gamble's going to be cool and fun in that cube, and that's the kind of weird variance I'm down for in the Neoclassical cube that I would probably not be down for in the Bun Magic cube. It feels more at home there, where there's more goofy stuff going on and a bigger power level band.
It was cool. And sad.
there's no better description of Magic. It's funny, that card really just like takes the variance of a game of Magic and like just gives you one shining, undeniable example of it, right? Like, you think about any build around in your deck, and it's like, well, this card's good as long as I draw some of the, like, card it's good with, and you don't necessarily feel the times when it doesn't happen, and Gamble's like, this card is good as long as I roll a 4 right now, instead of, like, you know, it's like, it's the same kind of variance, it's just very...
explicit.
Very explicit. So explicit. That's a NC-17 Magic card right there. On this episode, Anthony, we're going to be reviewing some of the deck lists and pools we got from our cubes at KubeCon. This is not going to be a like completely thorough analysis, because to be honest, I wanted this to be a thorough analysis, Anthony, but it's taking me so long to go through all these images, document all these deck lists, to actually start to quantify any of the data. I say data in air quotes. It is data, but it's not enough data to be like statistically significant, so I could kind of balk a little bit at calling it data, but it is data. But to get into a place where I can actually like work with it and like run numbers against it is taking me forever. Bones, I don't know how you did it for all three of your cubes at KubeCon so quickly. Everyone should check out Bones' great article on Medium where he analyzes the results of his own cubes, the Iganjo Drift, Amonkhar Desert Cube, and the Modern Darlings Cube. We're going to link that in the show notes, and yeah, I don't know how he did it so fast. It's going to take me a lot longer. So this is not going to be a like deep dive, but I think it actually will be more helpful to talk about it at this stage where like I've looked through all the pictures, I've like captured all of the vibes and like archetypes and directions of the deck lists. I don't have individual card data, but the more I think about this, the more I think individual card data is not actually going to be that useful, and we'll talk about why. So I want to talk about our overall impressions, first impressions of the results from KubeCon for each of our cubes, and also what, if anything, we're going to look into any deeper. I don't know if you have any plans to actually do any further analysis on your cubes. You kind of seemed like yesterday, like maybe that was not interesting to you.
I'm definitely going to like keep those pictures around, and as I continue to make updates, use that to inform it. And, you know, if I'm thinking, hey, does this feel a little bit strong? Maybe I can actually back that up with some more, not totally accurate data that's like statistically significant, like you're saying, but still useful. I don't know if I'm going to go through and actually like catalog all the decks and try and do any kind of more statistical analysis, because yeah, that's a lot of work. It's a lot of work, and ultimately like the qualitative experience of what's working, what's fun, I think is a lot more important for a cube. I think this is very different if you're Wizards of the Coast trying to design a limited format. That kind of data is really important because you want to make sure you don't have one color that's way outperforming others, because a lot of people are going to be playing it and that's going to be identified and felt. That's not necessarily the case with cubes that we're playing at, you know, the local weekly cube night.
I mean, I think it is the case to some degree. There's been very little disagreement in the playgroup for a long time that, for example, red is the best color in the regular cube.
Really? I feel like there has been a lot of disagreement about that.
It's definitely been
in the, like, Mardu colors have been the best colors, although green's gotten a couple updates that have made it a lot more. I think the only thing that is unequivocal is that blue is the worst color in the regular cube.
Yes, though I did draft a mostly blue deck in our latest rotisserie draft, and I have high hopes for that deck, so TBD whether or not that deck can actually hang with some of the best things in the environment, but no, I don't know. I mean, from at least talking to the people I talked to about the balance of the regular cube, I feel like James and I have had a long-running argument as to whether or not red-black or... I guess, actually, no, James thinks black-white is the best color combination in the cube, or at least used to. This was a while ago. Either way, I feel like even in our sort of small play group where we don't play the same cube every week, we're playing different cubes all the time, the cubes that do show up a lot, like the regular cube and the Bun Magic cube, there does get to be a reputation around what's good and what's bad. There was definitely a grumbling a while ago that blue was no good in the Bun Magic Cube. You couldn't play blue because all the threats were too good. So I feel like that does come up, even if it's not to the same degree as, you know, a regular set Wizards of the Coast designs and releases.
Yeah, I mean, I could say one thing just looking at the decks, the 3-0 decks specifically from KubeCon, is that you can play any color you like in regular cube and 3-0 as long as you're also playing red cards.
Yeah, I think red is... I think it's the best color in the regular cube. I think it's also probably the best color in the Bun Magic Cube. I think it's the kind of color that kind of naturally has a pretty narrow range of power level. Like, just the band on red cards, given the range of what red is allowed to do, the floor is going to be quite high on a lot of the red cards, because the main reason is that so much of red's removal is also burn, which
right.
is so much more useful in other ways, whereas the cost of getting stuck with a removal spell in hand that can't hit a particular target in white or black decks or whatever is a really steep cost, and red never has to deal with that at all. And on top of that, its threats are very proactive, and it's just kind of... It doesn't do a lot of cute stuff in most cubes. I mean, I think like maybe artifact synergies are the one thing I can think of that you could maybe describe as like kind of cute things that red decks get up to. But for the most part, it's doing just power and toughness, and its removal is very flexible. And so I think just naturally the color's identity makes it have a very high floor, and the ceiling... I don't know. It's something I felt from looking through the decks from the Bun Magic Cube is not that... We should talk more about just limitations of his data, but I noticed that I think that the decks that did poorly because of the poor floor on cards. And it wasn't that the decks that did well were crushing because of the really high ceiling. It was they were crushing because they were consistent and they didn't have to suffer with that low floor sometimes. So I think that's a big part of why red does tend to be quite good, and at least the kind of cubes we design.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just looking through some of these decks, and it's like, it feels like it's really easy to get into a good red deck, where it's like, oh, I'm playing green-black, I'm going to play this Karazda Guildmage, and like, get some creatures in play and do some extra steps to get some value out of it, whereas, like, red has Lightning Strike. This is always going to be good in multiple different situations. It's just, like, really easy to take this card and have it perform, so it does feel like that is a big factor. I also wonder about the regular cube having a pretty narrow power band, if that actually is going to highlight some of these imbalances more, whereas if I have, you know, a couple bombs that stand out in every color, then sure, there's going to be some variance where somebody's going to open up this power outlier in any one of these colors and take away the 3-0, whereas if it really does rely on these minor differences and there aren't big things that stand out, are we going to see that sort of like lower variance result in less variance in the kinds of decks that are going to perform?
I think as a cube designer, it's natural to want to get like card-specific conclusions from this data, because that is the scale on which we make changes, right? I'm going to add or remove cards from the cube based on the performance of these decks at KubeCon. But something I noticed from the Bun Magic Cube data is that any individual card shows up all across decks of all different records, right? You can find 3-0 Lurrus decks, 1-2 Lurrus decks, 0-3 Lurrus decks, and 2-1 Lurrus decks, right? Like, it's not that Lurrus is inherently broken, right? Same goes for some of the other more identifiably powerful cards in the cube, like Fable of the Mirror Breaker, Renin 6, Ragavan. Uro, actually, conspicuously missing from some of the best performing pools. There actually were very few Uro decks that did really, really well, but plenty of Uro decks that did not well, and I don't think that's an indication that Uro is bad in this cube, obviously. I hope that goes without saying. So it's even though there's this like tendency to want to gather card-level conclusions, because that would so directly inform cuts and adds, right? You could be like, oh, this card always wins, so I will obviously cut it. Or, oh, this card always lose, I will obviously cut that card. I don't think that's actually the kind of conclusions you can safely make from this data, because of all the variants inherent in it. And again, just from looking at my data, like, there is no trend in cards played across, like, winningest or least winningest decks. And I'm going to crunch the numbers to actually verify this, but, you know, one anecdotal thing I noticed is that Stoneforge Mystic showed up in a ton of really high-performing decks. And that's a card I sometimes, in the Bun Magic Cube, get criticized because I don't run Batterskull, I don't run Cauldra. I get people being like, why do you play Stoneforge Mystic? You don't have either of the cards that are good with Stoneforge Mystic. Obviously, I don't include those because I don't like the play patterns of cheating a creature into play, right? I consider that very much cheating mana the same way that Reanimator would cheat mana, right? To actually, like, just go put a Cauldra into play off a Stoneforge Mystic. But the reality is that Stoneforge Mystic plus Lion's Ash, Glimmer Lens, Umezawa's Jitte, whatever, like, plus a little package of otherwise much more fair equipment where you're still just drawing a card, casting it, equipping normally, is still very, very good, I think. And I think that's an example of, like, do I think Stoneforge Mystic is an overperformer in this cube? It's, like, too good for the Bun Magic cube. Absolutely not. I don't think it is at all. I think it is often part of a strategy that ends up being successful, and anecdotally, over the course of KubeCon weekend, just ended up being in decks that perform pretty well, more or less by a little bit of variance and by the fact that, yeah, it is actually good.
Yeah, I mean, a big part of that is just sort of the bias of the players. These are not decks that are built by the time-traveling supercomputer that has brute-forced every possible combination. And I think that bias will show in things like that, where a lot of players will look at Stoneforge Mystic and say, this card is not supported here. Like, there is not the combo that I'm used to. But I think a lot of very skilled players will be like, yeah, there actually is just a lot of value to be gained here. And I think that we're going to see that. And similar here, I feel like a lot of good players are just going to be like, yeah, I'm going to skip this cute synergy in the regular cube and just take this burn spell because it's flexible. There's a lot of different narratives we could use to try and describe why these things are happening. But
yeah, something I wonder is, what we don't have, obviously, is, like, pick order, right? And I think it's entirely possible that a lot of players got very late Stoneforge Mystics because a lot of other players looked at the pool and said, well, he's no Batterskull or Cauldra, why would I ever play this card here? And then you're, like, you know, black-white midrange or black-white aggro deck just gets Stoneforge Mystic on the wheel. And now you have a very good card for your deck that you didn't have to spend a high pick on. You got to spend that high pick on fixing. You got to spend the high pick on a sought-after removal spell. Something that we wouldn't look at the pool immediately and, like, see. Whereas, on the other side, I did notice that Skullclamp was a card that, once I crunch the numbers, I'll be able to see this, I think, evidenced, but from anecdotally looking through all the pools, it seemed like Skullclamp underperformed. It was just in a lot of list that 1-2'd or 0-3'd or 0-2 dropped didn't show up in a lot of high-performing lists. And I think maybe that's because we talked about how that card, I think, is often overrated in this environment. And that's not to say that putting Skullclap in your deck is wrong, but if these players that had it in their pool took it very highly because they are used to it being a broken card that is banned in Legacy or whatever, then that is a recipe for your draft going a little bit off the rails because you spent a really high pick on a card that actually shouldn't be a high pick. And so there's a lot of invisible information here that we're not getting that I think colors the interpretation of this data.
For sure.
So overall, how did you feel about the spread of decks for... Let's start with the regular cube and just focus on that. Like, were you happy with the decks that turned out and the records you saw? I mean, you mentioned Reb is a little bit overperforming. Like, how did you feel overall about everything, though?
Yeah, I mean, this is... It's sort of just like a bizarre situation to be in where, like, when we first started designing cubes, a conversation I'm sure we had at some point was like, wow, wouldn't it be cool to, like, have a pod of, you know, 8 LSVs play this cube and actually try and, like, break it and solve it and identify the issues? And at that point, I would have been like, yeah, this would be embarrassing. Like, they would just drive sideways across all of the synergies and all the themes and plans and just break it, literally, like, make it not fun. And so, I mean, my overall impression was like, wow, there's, like, lots of two-color decks here that are trying to do synergistic things, trying to play into the themes, and I feel good about that. So, like, there are some potentially color balance issues that I'm going to think about. Are there small ways to address? I mean, the obvious one is just, like, we've talked about Earthshaker Kenra is, like, a little bit of a power outlier, not that fun, and it's just really easy. And it's like the next thing that's going to be cut, and I'm just going to do that with a lot more confidence now. Like, mm-hmm. This is a card that just makes it really easy to get into red and is always going to overperform. But I don't think I'm going to make any huge changes based on this. It's like, yeah, the cube kind of worked like I wanted it to. We got giant growth in this deck here. Neat.
Yeah, I overall felt similarly. Like, looking at the results from the Bud Magic Cube, my overall impression was like, I succeeded. My cube...
We did it. We can stop the podcast. We're done.
Well, no, I mean, like, I hope it's the case, right? Because, you know, compared to how much time Wizard spends working on a, like, Retail Limited set, obviously the sum total human work hours is a lot more for Retail Limited set, but I've been working on this cube for 7 years, right? And they don't work on sets for 7 years with, like, constant updating and improving. So I've spent a lot of time on this list. I certainly hope it results in the kinds of matches and games that I want, and from looking at the pools, I think that actually is the case from the KubeCon pictures. There were, in the Bun Magic cube, like I said, cards showing up across the whole spectrum of records. There were color combinations showing up across the whole spectrum of records. There were some patterns, which we'll get to, but for the most part, yeah, you can play any color in the Bun Magic Cube. You can play a monocolored deck. You can play a five-colored deck. You can play everything in between and have success or have awful failure with them, right? There was really no obvious, like, stark pattern. And one thing that I really like seeing, you know, one thing that we don't actually need a bunch of other data to inform is just the range of decks people drafted, right? Like, put the records aside, right? How often are people ending up in monocolored decks, two-colored decks, three-colored decks, four or more colored decks? And that is a distribution I was actually very happy with in the Bun Magic Cube. There were, I think, you know, 5 or 6 monocolored decks over the entire weekend, which is quite a few. There were mostly two-colored decks and 2.5-colored decks, maybe 2-colored decks with a splash, which is exactly what we said on the podcast was my experience from playing in our local play group. And there were probably 5, 6, 7, you know, 4 or 5-color decks that were trying to be more ambitious. And those, again, all across all the different records. There was one 3-0 deck that was, looks like at least 4-color. I didn't have a deck builder this one, so I couldn't actually tell how it was built. But there was a 3-0 deck that had, you know, 4 colors. And there was an 0-3 deck that had a very similar pool in terms of, like, the actual cards. But I think some important, like, underlying differences that are not obvious from looking at the pool immediately, but if you start to unpack it a little more, you can start to figure out why one of these decks was so successful and one was had so much not success, was so unsuccessful. That's the word, unsuccessful.
Unsuccessful.
So overall, yeah, I'm really happy, and I am not planning on making any sweeping changes to the cube based on these results, which I think is good, because if you end up at a place like this and you do have, let's say, just one color that's broken, right? You're like, oh, well, every single 3-0 deck was this color, and it was playing some combination of this strategy, and no deck with that color combination ever did worse than, you know, 1-1-2, right? It was like, it was always performing pretty well. Then you're in a situation where you can make the change to fix that, but it's so hard to glean any other information from the draft when you have such a big outlying impact, right? When the data is dominated by this one trend, it's so much harder to see any other meaningful trends inside of it.
Yeah, I think that's a great point that almost more important than the records is just going to be what the actual decks are like and what the color pairs ended up being drafted, because that says more about what people are trying to do, like what signals people are picking up on. And I do see, even though, again, like there's a little bit of a bias in which decks are in the 3-0 bucket, there are a pretty diverse mix of all the color pairs, maybe with the exception of one or two that I'm not really seeing.
So overall, both very happy. Good job. Pat ourselves on the back. I am going to make some changes based on this information. I want to talk about some specific aspects of the Bun Magic Cube. So we had Dom on, and Dom drafted this cube on Thursday night before anybody else had a chance to draft it in the main event, and told me on the podcast, you all heard, and also told me afterwards at the event, like, hey, I think you're wrong. I think in this cube, you just take 4 and 5 mana spells, and you are guaranteed to get enough 1 and 2 mana stuff because there's so many cheap spells running around in this cube that it's basically impossible not to have a good curve. So just focus on the big stuff and go over the top of all your opponents, and that'll be a dominant strategy. And for Dom, that strategy has been very successful. Dom's overall record in this cube is 8-1 in matches, and he's always played green in every single deck he's drafted. 2 times he's drafted basically a like green deck splashing a little blue and white, and in the last draft he played a Jund deck. So Dom definitely has a strategy he likes in this cube, and Dom is a much better player than you or I, and so I take his observations very seriously. I think that he has very relevant observations to make about this environment. But it's worth noting that Dom's perceived dominant deck in this environment was definitely not borne out by the KubeCon data writ large. And it's not been borne out in our playgroup either. Like, yes, sometimes a deck like that does really well, but oftentimes they just get stomped and they end up 1-2 or whatever. And that's what I saw in this data, right? Like, the actual trends, I think, of the best performing decks at KubeCon, aggro was really good in this cube at KubeCon. The 3-0 decks were a red-white aggro deck, a black-white Lurrus deck, which is kind of inherently pretty aggressive, a very aggressive blue-red spells deck. Then there was a bigger Jund deck and a bigger 4 or 5 color Golos deck that 3-0'd. And then there was a mono-white aggro with a little bit of a green splash. So the 3-0 decks were looking at 4 aggro decks and then like 2 big mid-range decks that pulled down the 3-0. So that would certainly indicate that Dom's strategy is not dominant for everybody. And that's the thing, right? Like, if all of the players drafting these decks were Dom Harveys, would these decks have done much better? Probably, right? I think a lot of Dom's success with the archetype is that Dom is a much better than average Magic player. And so when he sits down across from somebody else who drafted a different deck, a lot of the difference in the power level of the decks will be overshadowed by the difference in the skill of the player.
I've definitely felt that in our local play group, where some player that is very skilled will draft a particular deck consistently, be like, yeah, this is the best deck in the cube. And it's like, well, I think you could do whatever you want and still win. And so it's like, I don't know if that's actually a useful piece of data.
And I do also want to like emphasize that I don't actually put a huge amount of emphasis on the specific records. And I'll give an example as to why. I watched the Sunday qualifier draft, like the second half of it. I watched the like end of round 2 and then all of round 3 for my own Bun Magic Cube, because I was at the venue. I had nothing else to do. Might as well watch the like highest stakes the Bun Magic Cube was going to be played for all weekend to get into top 8. And the deck that 3-0'd that pod was the aforementioned mono-white aggro deck with a little bit of green. It had green for like Tarmogoyf, Collected Company. That might have been it. Maybe a gold card. Maybe like
That's got to make you happy, right?
Oh, it does. I think a deck was really cool. Maybe like a Kasali Pride Mage or something. But it was basically a mono-white aggro deck, more or less. And it was playing up against a blue-white control deck, a like solid full-on control deck in the finals. And you'll notice that of those decks I just listed in the 3-0 category, none of them were control decks. And I do think control is harder to play in this cube, but I don't think it's not viable, because I watched the finals match. It was a really, really, really tight match that could absolutely have gone either way, right? So at the end of the day, yes, the mono-white aggro deck got the 3-0 and the blue-white control deck got the 2-1. But if they play that match 8 times, right, I think it's entirely possible that it breaks evenly or even breaks in favor of the control deck because the matchup was so close. So to look at the deck list that got 3-0 and say, well, this is the better deck than the deck that got 2-1, I don't think really holds water. I think you have to say, like, these are both successful decks, right? And they are on this spectrum, this tier of successful deck that will be competitive in this cube in any pod. And competitive means anywhere from, like, 3-0 to maybe 1-2 if the weather's bad for you that day, right? Like, you can have a competitive deck that still does poorly. And what I'm trying to get from looking at these pools is, what are the competitive decks and what are the non-competitive decks? Like, when can I actually look at a pool and be like, I can understand why this is non-competitive? And that's what I care more about than the specific records, per se. What are other patterns you did notice in the KubeCon data for the regular cube? or what are patterns you were like interested in trying to tally up? I know you're not going to do the whole like card by card analysis thing, which actually I do think the more I dig into this, I think the return on the time spent to like actually digitize all of these deck lists into like a spreadsheet and then calculate the like match win percentage of every card. Like, I do think the return on that is pretty low because of all the reasons we just mentioned. So if you don't care about that, what do you care about, if anything, in terms of identifying patterns from these pool pictures?
I mean, I think the biggest thing is just going to be looking for particular outliers and sort of testing my own assumptions about are there power outliers that I think are dictating the games or not? And overall, it seems like not really. Like I mentioned, Earthshaker Kenra is a card that's a little bit overpowered. It's maybe drawing people into red, but I don't know that I'm actually seeing it in a bunch of the 3-0 decks that are would otherwise, you know, happily play it. So I think that I am interested in those individual sort of card analysis, and I'm prepared to be surprised by it.
Okay, so you are interested in the card-by-card stuff. I'm really not that much. I'm going to do it, I think, because I want to digitize the list anyway, but what I'm more interested in looking at, I think, is the densities of different types of effects across the same strategy across different records. So when I was going through here, for example, I was looking at all of the like blue-red spells decks, another archetype that had a 3-0, had a bunch of 2-1s, a couple 1-2s, and an 0-3. It was all across the board. And I think what's going to be more evident in terms of what makes that deck tick is not going to be looking at which decks had Ragavan and which decks had Fable the Mirror Breaker and which decks had Expressive Iteration, because, again, those show up across the entire range. You can find 0-3 decks of Ragavan. You can find 3-0 decks of Ragavan. It's not that Ragavan makes your deck an 0-3 or a 3-0 deck. What I think will make your deck an 0-3 or a 3-0 deck is the relative densities of one mana cantrips in that Spellslinger deck, of counter magic in that Spellslinger deck, of threats versus interaction in that Spellslinger deck, of fixing.
That's a really good question. I'm looking through these decks, I'm a little bit surprised to see a lot of them seem light on fixing in terms of the successful decks.
Editing Andy here. Just for clarity, we start talking about the regular cube right here. We just transition. When Anthony says he's looking at these decks, he means from the regular cube. We don't ever say it out loud. I'm not sure how he and I communicated that so clearly in the conversation, but cluing you in. Now we are transitioning from talking about the Bun Magic Cube to the regular cube. That's something I actually wondered if that would be the case sometimes. You and I actually, in the most recent roto draft of this cube, maybe taking a page from the Justin Parnell book of roto drafting.
No, I definitely was not inspired by Justin Parnell to draft Korean
Red. I didn't even mean specifically drafting the exact same archetype. I just meant that in our roto draft we did with Parnell and a bunch of other friends of ours at MagicCon Philly, Parnell intentionally, very explicitly, was like, I'm not fighting you for the like Prismatic Vistas or like the like lands that go in any deck, which there aren't a ton in the regular cube. Everybody else had a couple rounds where they were like taking their one or two Prismatic Vistas. We were like fighting over them a little bit. And Justin was just taking good cards for his deck. And then he just played, what, 3 or 4 fixing lands in his like red-green deck, just whatever red-green duels he could get that no one else really wanted, and had plenty of success. I think it's entirely possible that in the regular cube, the amount of fixing you are rewarded for, like the return on investment in fixing, falls off pretty quickly because you can't ever end up with like a over-the-top amazing mana base just because of the nature of your fixing, right? You don't have fetches and shocks, so you're not going to ever, you're never going to have a two-color mana base that's like 12 of each source, right? That just is not possible to happen in that cube.
No, I mean, your best case is like 3-4 dual lands, and maybe you have another 2 dual lands for a splash.
Yeah, and a lot of your dual lands come into play tap, so even if you have all of them, there's the question of how many do you actually want to play.
Yeah.
In the roto deck, I just finished drafting of the regular cube in our most recent rotisserie draft. I'm playing blue-black, and there was nobody else playing any blue-black, and so I could get all of the dual lands if I wanted, and I was just like, I don't want 4 tapped lands in my deck. I'll play 3. I don't want the 4th. I just think it's too many. So I just didn't even take it. So I did wonder if that would be the case in the regular cube, if like there's a sweet spot of fixing where like you want to be able to cast your spells, but you don't want to spend high picks on fixing when it's so important to grab the synergistic pieces, grab the like relatively few really high quality removal spells. Like, I think there's more things in the regular cube that are higher picks than fixing than in a cube like the Bun Magic Cube, perhaps.
Yeah, I could definitely see that being true.
I think one of the most obvious patterns for me from the Bun Magic Cube deck pictures was the density of fixing being highly correlated with a deck doing well. And this may be projecting too much, but my thinking, because I've heard this from many players before, many people have told me, you run so many lands in this cube, I don't have to prioritize them at all. I'm just going to have a good mana base no matter what. And I can say very clearly from looking at a lot of these 1-2 decks that that is absolutely not the case. There are tons of 1-2 decks in this collection of photos that have terrible fixing. They're playing three colors with one fetch land and three shock lands, and one of their colors isn't even fetchable. They're playing a two-color deck with one shock and one fetch, which, by numbers, is way below average what you should have in this cube. I run 81 lands, most of which are fixing lands, so you could have, on average, 10 non-basic lands for your deck, and here are pools, entire pools with, two, three, or four fixing lands for their deck, and these are tons of the decks that are in the 1-2 and 0-3 sections, where they just didn't get fixing. I don't know what happened in those players' drafts. I could imagine that maybe they were like, I don't have to prioritize fixing, they didn't, and they got hard punished for it. Which is something I'm totally okay with. If you don't prioritize fixing in this cube, I do not expect you to do well. I'm not interested in trying to...
rude.
I'm not interested in trying to, smooth out that edge, right? That's a big part of what cube design is all about. Your player comes to the pod with some expectations. They draft with a strategy. How much do you want to reward or punish that strategy? I am happy to punish the strategy of thinking that fixing is free as hard as possible.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely an interesting thing to try and quantify, and it's interesting to hear that sort of, panning out in that way. And the difference between these two environments. Yeah, I mean, again, I feel like that is successful implementation of design goals.
Yeah, I consider that a success, that I think the players that prioritize fixing ended up with the better decks and were more consistent. The consistency, I think, is one of the things that it's... I tried to talk about it when we were doing the primer on how to draft the Bun Magic Cube, is that, in regular the cube drafts, you cannot do anything for the first few turns, and it's fine. And in this cube, you can't. You have to be doing things on turn one, turn two, turn three, and if what you're doing is waiting to draw your blue source, you're going to be way behind. The consistency of a good mana base, I think, is a much higher indicator of a deck's success in this collection of deck lists than presence of any one or two cards, right? Again, the presence of individual cards was not the defining story of how these decks ended up ranked into these different records.
Sure, yeah.
Which I'm really glad about. That's what I want. I want you to be able to take the best cards in the cube and still end up with an 0-3 deck if you don't draft properly. And I want you to be able to put together a 3-0 deck without any huge power outliers, which is definitely true. There are decks in the 3-0 or 2-1 section here that didn't have any of the cards that I mentioned as the top 10 cards in the cube, because that's not the driving narrative behind what makes a deck successful in this environment. And I'm really happy about that.
Sure. I'm just looking for any deck that looks like it was playing Earl of Squirrel here and having no luck.
I don't think you're going to find it, sadly. Another pattern that was somewhat noticeable in the Bun Magic pools was blue definitely seems harder to play here successfully. Again, I don't think that means it is bad or a trap. I think it just means that it is challenging. It's more challenging to do well with blue than it is to do well with a Proactiv deck. The only blue that showed up in the 3-0 lists was a blue-red spells deck that was really aggressive. It really only had four or five blue cards. It was mostly mono-red, plus the blue-red gold cards, plus Treasure Cruise and Mana Leak, right? It was kind of almost splashing blue in a mono-red list. Or it was showing up in the four-color deck in which blue is not really core to the identity there. It's mostly a green deck that plays Golos and Field of the Dead, and it does have Uro, but to say it's a blue deck is kind of a misnomer. It's not really playing all the blue cards that make blue blue. There were a smattering of blue lists in the 2-1, and I also had I did have a draw in the finals, which is kind of a bummer. There were two 2-0-1 decks, and they must have played each other in the finals to end up with those records, and it was a blue-black slash maybe Esper control list. Again, I don't have the build, so I don't actually know if they were splashing those white cards, but a really good-looking blue-black control list against a red-white aggro list that evidently went to turns and couldn't finish in time, which the control versus aggro matchup is not one you expect to go to turns and not finish in time, and I want to say that had they had infinite time, that almost certainly means that the blue blacklist would have come out on top, because the aggro list is going to turns with the control list. You got to hope in a long game the control list is favored. Again, I'm trying not to take the actual record as that important, but just recognizing that this is clearly a viable deck. This blue black control deck this person drafted, clearly viable in the Bun Magic Cube. And then there are a smattering of control lists in the 2-1s, the various Jeskai control lists, blue-white control lists. But I do think that the inherent contextual nature of so many cards in a control list means that things have to go a little bit right for you to not drop games, right? Whereas a purely proactive deck has this benefit of just not having that many narrow or context-specific cards, right? You're the one being proactive. You're the one that's setting the tempo. You set the game plan. You don't have to worry about whether your opponent's going to have the right kinds of targets for your counter spells or removal spells, or whether or not you're going to have the Wrath on time, because you are just pressuring your opponent. And given the consistency of the decks in the Bud Magic Cube, I can see how it is a little harder for control decks to keep up, or just, even if they can keep up most of the time, just never stumble, right? It's hard to never stumble as a control deck in this cube and always have what you need when you need it, which means that you end up with a lot of 2-1s because your deck was great, it was successful, it was very viable in the environment, but the chances that you play 3 matches back-to-back and don't stumble once are low.
It's funny to me how a lot of the conventional wisdom for the way to draft the Magic Online cubes, like the Legacy and Vintage cubes, is just draft aggro. You know, don't try and do this big splashy thing that is kind of what the cube is all about. It's kind of the headline. But instead, just be the one asking the questions, be really proactive.
Specifically, if you want to win. Yeah, that's what I hear a lot.
But this is like a very, very different environment than those cubes. And it's sort of funny to me. Like, do you think that there's a parallel there, or they like are aggro decks successful for different reasons in these different environments?
I think maybe for slightly different reasons, or like a nuanced different reason. I think in the like Magic Online Vintage Cube, from what I've seen, and again, never played it myself, but from what I've seen watching a lot of matches online or from talking to people, it seems like what a lot of people are trying to do is actually not necessarily win, but like have fun, and they want to draft their like cool splashy deck. And in that context, aggro can really punish your opponent for trying to do Birthing Pod Kiki combo in a like singleton draft environment from a 540 card cube where they're not even going to see all the cards, right? Like, you're trying to be ambitious. Things have to go right for you for your deck to work, and your opponent's just like, play one, drops an attack, and what are you going to do? And I think it's a similar reason, right? Except in the Bun Magic Cube, I don't think most players are trying to do that sort of ambitious thing that's only going to come together one in every 4 or 5 games. Like, that's not really the way the cube works. There's not really ambitious things of that kind to be doing in the first place. It's really just more about your deck's going to be so much more consistent. The aggro decks here are so much better than the aggro decks in the Magic Online Cube, because it's a much smaller cube, because I really prioritize aggro as a like primary archetype. So the decks are way better than they are in the Magic Online Vintage Cube, the aggro decks. And even if you are building a control deck that is specifically aware of those decks, right? Like, so many times people draft big blue decks in the Magic Online Vintage Cube, and you hear them say, hope I don't come against mono white or mono red. Like, just hope I don't see them, because I'm going to lose, because I'm just, my deck is not set up to beat those decks. I don't think that happens in this cube. I don't think people say, I hope I don't see aggro, and I'll just, you know, coast to a victory. I think you're playing a control deck with the knowledge that you are trying to beat the aggro decks, and it's just, it's hard to do. It's hard to do consistently.
Yeah, I mean, that consistency is really, really important when you're trying to win 3 matches back-to-back.
Yeah. Something has to be the best thing, I think, ultimately. We all might want to dream of a like getting these pools back from KubeCon, or getting a bunch of draft data back and seeing that every single color identity is exactly equally supported and the win rates of all of the colors are exactly equal. Maybe that's an ideal that we're all striving for, but in reality, I don't think that's actually practically possible. I think something's going to be the best thing. And for aggressive decks to be the best thing in this cube, I am okay with that. I like a place where the aggressive decks are the best thing to do. I don't like a place where what Dom described as is the best thing to do. And to be honest, the idea that that's even possible, that maybe there is an exploit in this environment that you can just play the Dom Harvey deck every single time, I would be much less happy if that was the deck that was maybe overperforming than the decks that maybe are overperforming based on this data, which is like red aggro decks that just play nothing that costs more than 3 mana and only 2 or 3 3 drops. That's the kind of Magic I want this cube to be about. And so I think a lot of cube designers would be well served to, instead of thinking about trying to make their environment balanced so nothing was the most powerful thing, just make the powerful thing what you want the environment to be about. Just let something be the best thing and don't worry about it too much. That's kind of where I'm at with like the aggressive decks. I'm not worried about trying to nerf those decks per se.
I mean, that makes, I think, the design process a little bit easier when you say this is kind of the starting point. This is the thing that other decks have to try and beat, and then let's balance everything in proportion to that. That's like a much easier sort of narrative to talk through how your design process is than here are 5 things I'm trying to make all balanced together against each other. That's just difficult.
Yeah. So I don't want to nerf that deck because it performed well, but I will say that I would love to make control a little more viable. And specifically, some of the most consistent low-performing decks in the data were blue-black control decks. It seems clear that blue-white is the more favorable control combination than blue-black based on at least this small sample size of data. And I would love to make those decks better, but I am kind of at a loss for how to. And this is where me curating a cube at the peaks of power level is a big limiting factor. I don't just have better blue and black control cards I can go put in. I'm kind of already playing all of them, right? It's really hard for me to figure out how I can make that deck any better. And that's the only real argument, I think, to maybe nerfing everything else a little bit, is just to make the control decks a little better. To go back to Dom's observation about my environment, it really stuck with me and kind of haunted me a little bit for one specific reason. Not because he said he thinks this deck is the best, but he said he thinks it's the best because of how low curving the environment is. His suggestion was, I'll just play these 4 and 5 drops because I know I'll get enough 1, 2, and 3 drops just naturally by the way the cube is structured. If you were trying to change the environment to make it so this deck is no longer dominant, your natural inclination, I think, would be to give more game pieces to the decks that are not playing that strategy. So play more things at the low curve. Give Dom less 4 and 5 drops to take. This thing he says is the best thing. Give him less of that. But his suggestion is that that very strategy is what has caused this to be the best thing, and that somehow counterintuitively, the way to maybe nerf that deck is actually to put more 4 and 5 drops in. So now when you're wheeling your, 13th pick in the pack, it's not going to be a random 2 drop that nobody wanted to play that you can put in your deck now and fill out your curve. It's going to be another 5 drop, and then you're going to be punished for having taken that 5 drop earlier. But I don't want to put more high curving stuff in here. I do fundamentally think that that would actually, while it may make drafting the kind of deck Dom described more tricky, I do think on the overall experience of the whole draft, you look at all of the matches being played across 3 rounds, it's just going to mean everybody's doing higher curving, bigger stuff, and I don't want that. And so,
yeah, I mean, you can't just target change that one strategy. Like, you're going to change the entire environment if precisely. You make a big change, like raising the curve by, half a mana value.
So here's Dom, a great player, saying, hey, this strategy I think is dominant. Me thinking, that's not a strategy I want to be dominant. I'd much rather have the best deck in my cube be like a Delver deck or an aggro deck than a big mid-range deck. And him also saying, oh, and by the way, the only way you can maybe think to fix it, I think, would just make it better. Which is to say, like, if you put more low-curving stuff in, then I'm even more guaranteed to wheel that low-curve stuff, and I will just, again, take every 4 and 5 mana spell I see and just trust I'll get the low-curve stuff later. So I don't know what to do with that.
Have you tried asking him nicely?
I might ask him what he would do to try and make his strategy worse.
I mean, just ask him to stop doing this.
Oh, sure. Just please stop. Please stop. So I'm not sure what to do with that feedback as a designer. I think maybe one of the things I can do is introduce a little more risk into those 4 and 5 drop cards. Whereas right now, my guiding light for what 4 and 5 drops I include is I want them to, for the most part, be proactive in ending games. Like, I don't love 4 and 5 drops that just draw things out, except where they are necessary to do so for, control deck, right? Like, I like board wipes. I think it is important to have a density of board wipes in a cube like this so that players have to think about it and play around them and not just build the board wipe as big as possible and just jam. But naturally, a board wipe is, in this case, a 4-mana spell that is going to prolong the game. So I'm fine with them where they feel necessary to support an archetype I want to support. I don't want, for example, my 4 and 5 drops to just be interchangeable green planeswalkers that spit out tokens and just clog up the board, which can be very powerful cards, right? They can really draw the game out very long, and if the game's getting drawn out and you have a planeswalker that's ticking up, you are definitely favored. But I would much rather have a thing like Titania, Protector of Argoth, which is going to put, in most situations, at least 10 power into play the turn you play it in the Bun Magic Cube, and is not going to generate infinite value over time, is instead just going to put a lot of pressure on your opponent. Maybe one way I can do this is to just make those cards I include a little more risky, just a little more bad against removal spells, a little more Baneslayer-y, for lack of a better term, so that when Dom gets to that point of the curve, he's not just going to be safe in saying, well, I'm just going to play in 4 and 5 drops after each other, and that's surely going to be good enough to win, because your opponent might just have a Flame Slash, and then your whole strategy is kind of blown out of the water.
Yeah, I mean, a card like Asika's Chariot in particular really stands out, where no one card is going to answer that really at all.
On the other hand, I do like Asika's Chariot because so many cards do answer it somewhat, right? Like, there are a ton of partial answers to Asika's Chariot. There are a ton of things that kill a token, kill a 2 toughness creature, remove an artifact. There's a lot of ways to deal with...
Put Fiery Confluence back in.
No, absolutely not. There are a lot of ways to deal with portions of it, but not ways to deal with the entire thing. And I do like that kind of incremental value, but if that is what's contributing to this safety Dom feels of playing these 4 and 5 drops and just going over the top, then that's something I could possibly address. I also think that what Dom's strategy, I do think, is good against, is what I'm describing as naturally the best thing to do in the queue, which is aggro. I think Dom's strategy is very good against aggro. I'm just going to have whatever one and two drops I have. Doesn't matter what they are, because all their job is to trade off in combat with your one and two drops. Like, they could have any rules text imaginable. It literally doesn't matter. Could be Ragavan, could be Sun Gold Sentinel, could be whatever. It's just there to trade off in combat with your stuff. And then when we get to the late game, you're still going to be playing small stuff, I'm going to be playing big stuff, and I'll win. I think those decks are favored there. Where I think Dom's deck is not favored is against the control decks, where I have so much counter magic. Some of the better control decks from KubeCon, I was counting, you know, that previously mentioned blue-black control list that went 2-0 draw had 11 counterspells in it. I'm not sure how many remain decked, but 11 counterspells, and in this cube, they all cost 2 mana or less. And so to imagine sitting down and playing a deck full of whatever 1, 2, and 3 drops and then just big stuff you actually care about winning the game, you should never resolve any of those against that blue-black control deck. It should never happen. That's just how that matchup should go. And so I'm partially wondering if what Dom's experiencing is he's got a strategy that is good against what is best in the cube and maybe most dominant in the cube, and its weakness is just the thing that it maybe is hardest to do. And so maybe it happens sometimes, and the match loss I did see Dom take on the Sunday qualifier was to a blue-white control list that took Dom's Jund deck down. And so maybe it's just a matter of that deck being positioned in such a way that if I was able to make control a little better in the meta, which maybe wouldn't even necessarily involve card changes per se, but if I'm able to like make people draft that deck a little more or like know how to draft it a little more.
No card changes, so just asking people nicely.
I think the meta could shift in a way that, I don't know, I think like ultimately it is kind of the iconic rock, paper, scissors of like aggro, mid-range, and control, which is part of my guiding light here for the design of this cube. But when aggro is maybe a little up and control's a little down, right, that tilts things, and then theoretically it makes Dom's mid-range deck the best thing to do. But what we don't have is like that feedback loop where like if we had 8 Doms sitting down to draft the cube, I think the best thing to do would be a control deck at that point, right? And then you would know in that meta with this exact same card pool, now the best thing to do to get a 3-0 is just to draft a control deck with a bunch of counterspells and I will prevail. But that's just so hard to like... It's always going to be different in every meta, and so you can tell that I'm just kind of like whirling around trying to figure out how to, if at all, try and address this, I say problem in air quotes, because it's a problem for me as a designer. I don't think Dom was saying this is a problem with your environment. Maybe he loves those kinds of decks and loves that he can draft them here. I'm saying it's the kind of deck I don't want to be dominant. I don't want drafting this cube to be as simple as take the expensive cards, you'll get the cheap ones on the wheel, and just, you know, play to the board, and that's all you need to do. But I'm not convinced it is. And, you know, ultimately, we just have too small sample sizes to make any definitive statements about it.
Always the problem.
Do you have any closing thoughts about this, Anthony?
Yes, I've been looking at the Turbo Cube decks, and those are honestly a little bit more diverse than I expected. The Turbo Cube,
but your expectations were kind of low.
It's not necessarily the environment where I'm focusing on, you know, every color must be equally playable. It's more focused on the experience and just doing wild, crazy stuff. But we have a deck here, a 3-0 deck that has 2 copies of Jade Mage, and it's got Chatterfang, and I really hope those were in the main deck.
Fingers crossed.
So even if we didn't get people playing Earl of Squirrel in the regular cube, somebody made some squirrels out there.
I want to close this episode with a request. So I have all the pools from KubeCon. I have maybe like 10% of them have deck lists associated with them, or those people have sent me deck lists separately. If you are listening to my voice right now, and you drafted the Bun Magic Cube at KubeCon, and you did not upload a deck list to the Hedron Network, or did not separately send it to me in DMs or over Discord or whatever, I would love to see your deck list. If you have a picture, please hit me up on Twitter, @LuckyPaperMTG. Email it to mail@luckypaper.co. Find me on Discord. I'm Andy Mangold. Just send me your deck list. I am going to do a much more involved written analysis, which I consider this conversation to be like me trying to like get my head around what I want that written analysis to be. I have not done it yet, and I think this conversation has helped me figure out exactly what I want to highlight there. But it's so hard to know from a pool what the deck actually looked like. Harder than I thought, because there were a couple examples where we had a pool and had a deck image, and I looked at the pool before I looked at the deck image and figured out like what I would think that pool amounted to, and then based on the deck image, I was totally wrong. So I don't know what you're doing with these cards. I evaluate them differently than you do, so please, please, please send me deck lists if you have them. That is hugely appreciated. Do you want to make a similar request? Do you care, Anthony? Don't worry about sending him to Anthony. He's much more chill than I am. He's a much more zen.
Here's what I would much more value is just that qualitative experience. If there were cards that felt like they were underperforming or overperforming, or felt like traps, or some matches were frustrating, or some matches were really fun, like that kind of qualitative experience is extremely valuable. So if you played either the regular cube or the turbo cube at KubeCon, and I mean, I've had a lot of conversations with people about this already, but more feedback is always valuable.
Yeah, and I'll obviously take as much of that as you want to give me too, especially if it's any observations that would color the interpretation of your record, right? Like, here's my deck, and also I got mana screwed in 4 games, and it's like, okay, well, I can look at your deck then and figure out if the mana screw was pure variance. Well, I can look at a deck and say, like, actually, you know, you do have 10 sources for each of your colors. You objectively had a fine mana base, and just the weather was bad for you that day, and that happens sometimes. Or I can look at your pool and be like, yeah, you're one of these decks that had 1 fetch land, 2 shock lands, we're trying to play 3 colors. I'm not surprised that you got mana screwed. That's an expected outcome for this environment. So I will obviously welcome any of that qualitative feedback in addition to those deck pictures if you have them. This is also going to be your last chance to fill out the Lost Caverns of Ixalan and the Lost Caverns of Ixalan Commander Cube surveys. We are recording that Cube Community Set Review podcast episode later today, so you are already too late to have gotten it in for our podcast discussion, but those final numbers we actually published in the article, you still have some time to get your answers in for that, so make sure you go fill those out if you have a chance. Also, I want to mention that this Wednesday, which is November 22nd, so 2 days after this podcast comes out, I'm going to be streaming on Twitch watching some of the best French Magic players in the world decided to do a rotisserie draft of the Bun Magic Cube, and they're going to be playing the matches on Magic Online, so I'm going to be restreaming one of those and just chatting with people over top of it and watching some Bun Magic Cube gameplay with some roto decks, which tend to be the like most powerful examples of particular archetypes, so it's fun to watch. So tune in for that. We are currently planning on going live with that around 2:30 in the afternoon Eastern time on the 22nd. So check that out, twitch.tv/luckypapermtg. And if you want to come by and hang out too, Anthony, you're welcome to.
Sure, sounds like fun.
Anything else to tell people about?
I don't think so. If you're in the U.S., enjoy our weird holiday.
Yeah, it's a whole thing. Just
cook something nice.
Spend some time with your friends and family, and think about how you live on stolen land. It's very important to think about that. One more plug. Sign up for our newsletter on luckypaper.co. You can go down to the bottom. There's a newsletter sign up on the bottom of most pages, definitely on the homepage. We've got a playmat in the works. That I'm ready to say that there's a playmat in the works, which is exciting.
Wow. What a step.
I don't know when it's going to be available, but if you want to find out first and make sure you don't miss that, it's going to be another pre-order situation similar to the poster at KubeCon. So if you want to make sure you don't miss that pre-order and you don't listen to the podcast every week necessarily, make sure you sign up for our newsletter where you will hear about that. All right, that's it for real. Thank you for tuning into this episode of Lucky Paper Radio. All of our music is produced by DJ James Nasty. All the magic cards are produced by Wizards of the Coast. The show is produced by me spending like 3 or 4 hours looking at all these photos and just trying to figure out what these decks are all about and making sure I accounted for all the cards to maybe try and draw some conclusions about this, which will ultimately result in like 4 card swaps in the Bun Magic Cube. So,
but they'll be really important ones.
So important. Thanks for diving into this with me.
Yeah. Happy to talk about Cube.